From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Criminals, cops, and heavy weapons. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The International Association of Police Chiefs reports that high-caliber automatic weapons are increasingly common on the streets of American cities. Local police departments are fighting back with military-style armament of their own. But there's dispute about whether the arms race started when the federal assault weapons ban expired 3 years ago. On To the Point, was the assault weapons ban really all that effective? Are there other reasons both cops and criminals are more heavily armed? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Anna Nicole Smith and classic melodrama. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. Local cops claim they're increasingly outgunned by criminals with high-caliber automatic weapons, so the cops are beefing up their own armaments. On To the Point, the federal assault weapons ban expired 3 years ago. Has that produced an arms race in American cities? Was the ban really all that effective? On Reporter's Notebook, the mainstream media are taking heat for over-covering Anna Nicole Smith. Did they have any choice? First, this news update. When Congress returns next Tuesday, Democrats in both houses will be keeping up the pressure on President Bush and his plan for increasing troops in Iraq. In the Senate, there's talk of revising the authorization to use force passed in 2002. John Donnelly reports for Congressional Quarterly. John, always good to have you with us.
Likewise. Thanks.
Question of terminology here. Would it be a revision or would it in fact be a repeal of the authorization to use force?
They're still working on that. It hasn't been finalized yet. It would be a repeal or a revision. They're still trying to figure that out.
In any case, as I understand it, it would limit what the president could do in Iraq. How would it limit him?
Well, it would basically say that at a date that they're still trying to determine, or by a date they're still trying to determine, U.S. forces would be more limited in what they could do, limited to counterterrorism missions, fighting Al Qaeda inside Iraq, training Iraqi forces, sealing Iraq's borders, and providing logistics for those aforementioned operations. So there would be some kind of transition period set into the resolution. There would also be a goal set in there for when all troops, except for the ones I just mentioned, would have to be out of Iraq, and that would be probably March 31st, 2008, which is the date that was in the Iraq Study Group report.
Now, this would be binding as opposed to the resolution that failed to pass the Senate before they went on their President's Day vacation. Would this version be able to get Republican support?
The Democrats may pick off a few Republicans, but it remains to be seen whether they would get enough, and I think most people are doubtful that they would get enough. It may be close. It may be something like 56 senators, which is the number that they got in a procedural vote on February 18th, I think it was, which basically indicated the level of support that Democrats have. They picked off a few Republicans, but to get almost anything done in the Senate, you need at least 60 votes to cut off the possibility of a filibuster.
Okay, so this would appear at the moment at least to be unlikely to pass. What's going on in the House of Representatives?
Well, in the House, they passed their non-binding resolution that criticized the surge and also expressed support for U.S. troops. They next week, the House Appropriations Committee is probably on March 7th going to write its version of the war spending bill, the latest war spending bill for the remainder of this fiscal year. And in that bill, John Murtha, the top member of the defense spending panel, is advocating that they set real strict standards for the readiness of the troops, for the training, for the amount of time they're allowed to spend in the war zone. And it remains to be seen whether he is going to go forward with that in as full a form as he had previously advocated. There's some talk that they may be backing away from that, but that still remains to be seen.
Talking with John Donnelly, who covers defense and foreign policy for Congressional Quarterly, Speaker Pelosi was said to be favorable to the MIRTHA proposal. Is she having trouble getting enough Democrats to go along?
Well, she hasn't come out real clearly as to where she stands on that proposal. So I don't know if we can say that she's backed off it. Clearly Democrats have divisions on this question. They are concerned, many of them are concerned, that they would be portrayed as having cut off funding to troops in harm's way. And whether or not that's actually what they would do, they might be vulnerable to that charge politically. And so it's kind of it's something that they're terrified of dealing with, all of them, some of them more than others. But there's clearly divisions in their ranks. It's not clear precisely where Pelosi stands on the issue as of yet.
Wouldn't they, though, have the same problem getting enough votes in the Senate, even if the House were to pass something that cut off funding or appeared to be moving in that direction? They couldn't possibly get that through, could they?
It would definitely be difficult. It would definitely be difficult for that, to, even if it passed the House, to get through the Senate. You're right. But one thing we have to keep in mind as we discuss this is that the situation in Iraq, the political support for the war has continued to erode through time. And so, you know, in a month or two or three or four, we don't know how the politics of the situation may change. And that's when some of these things may, the supplemental spending bill, for example, may not come to a final vote for another more than a month away. And who knows how things might have gone further south in Iraq by then.
Or whether, in fact, the president's effort to increase the number of troops would have been completed. So it would be a fait accompli.
Well, it would have. It probably will be largely completed, but depending on how the language is written, it could conceivably call for some of those troops to come home.
Okay. John Donnelly, good to have you with us.
Likewise.
Again with Congressional Quarterly. In a moment, criminals, cops, and heavy weapons on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The International Association of Police Chiefs is a Washington lobby that represents local law enforcement around the country. The group informally surveyed 20 police departments and found they have been adding military-style weaponry to their arsenals since 2004. That was the year that the federal assault weapons ban expired and Congress failed to renew it. Kevin Johnson is reporting the story for USA Today. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Good to be with you.
What are some of the departments where, in fact, the police chiefs say that they are adding military-style armament?
Well, a few of the departments are Miami, the Orange County Sheriff's Department.
That's in Florida.
Yes, and Houston, Texas, and some others that were surveyed by the firearms chairman with the IACP.
What connection are they making between the need to get these kinds of armaments and the expiration of the assault weapons ban?
Well, the chairman of the Firearms Committee at the IACP cited the expiration of the assault weapons ban as a point at which he started seeing a number of departments moving in the direction to upgrade their own weaponry.
What does it mean when they upgrade the weaponry? What are they getting that they didn't have before?
Well, they seem to be moving toward a more high-powered, military-style assault weapon. And they cite that they have been seeing more of these on the street as they encounter suspects in robberies and also gang members who are carrying these weapons.
So they're saying then that they are responding to what they see on the streets. They have to up their arms because they're otherwise being outgunned?
Correct. That seemed to be a major argument of the chief in Houston, Harold Hurt, who indicated that in the past 3 years, his department has moved in that direction too, to upgrade its weaponry more because they've been dealing with a lot of an influx of gang members. They're also a transit point for human trafficking and drug trafficking in the United States.
What exactly do the automatic weapons and the military-style weapons allow the police to do that they couldn't do before?
Well, I think that their great fear is that they don't want to be outgunned, much in the style of, I think many folks remember the robbery in North Hollywood, California, when two suspects opened up on police with military-style weaponry of their own and caught the officers there with their standard issue revolvers. And so I think that that was a point at which people, and I think Mr. Earhart from one of the weapons manufacturers, who I think is going to be on your show, had indicated to me when he saw a surge of departments moving toward these kind of weapons.
We are going to talk with him, and the importance there is that North Hollywood incident, which some of our listeners may remember, occurred in 1997. It was an extraordinary moment when television cameras showed up, and there was essentially a military-style shootout on the streets of North Hollywood, a highly populated suburb or part of the city of Los Angeles.
Correct, correct.
And they were very heavily armed, the criminals were, and it was a fight to the death. Very, very dramatic
moment. It sure was, yeah.
Well, what about the discrepancy in dates here? If that happened in 1997, what's the support then for the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, that the armament all began in 2004?
Well, I think that, and I think Mr. Earhart will make this point, as he did to me, is that over time you see departments rethink their weaponry and how they're outfitted. And in 97, he had indicated that that's when he noticed, and others in his industry noticed, a move toward larger weapons, more high-powered weapons. But in this informal survey done by the IACP, Chief Scott Knight seemed to indicate that a number of departments, at least 20 that he surveyed, had indicated that they were moving in that direction in the aftermath of the expiration of the assault weapons ban. So I think what you're probably seeing are departments motivated by a number of issues, first by individual incidents, some by, you know, right after the incident at 9/11, where departments and many other agencies of the government began looking at how they're prepared to handle terrorist incidents as well.
Okay, and Chief Scott Knight is the man you referred to before, the chair of the Firearms Committee of the IACP.
Correct.
Kevin Johnson with USA Today. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
As advertised, Paul Earhart is with us, spokesperson for the firearms manufacturer SIG Arms, which is a major supplier of firearms to local and state and federal law enforcement agencies. Mr. Earhart, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me on.
What about the issue of when this began and what it has to do with the expiration of the assault weapons ban in 2004?
Well, as I had told Kevin when we spoke a couple days ago, that the assault weapons ban, when that sunsetted, we did not see a flurry of phone calls from agencies contacting us to place orders or to have, you know, a T&E gun, a test and evaluation gun, which we often send out to them to review. That simply didn't happen. We would be the company to know about it first, frankly. An example I gave him is right after Katrina, we got a phone call from an agency down in Louisiana that ordered 25 or 50 select fire rifles from us that go full auto for their purposes. I mean, that was an immediate need, an emergency need, wrapped around a natural disaster that showed how quickly a community or a major city can go, from everyday, normalcy to chaos. And we simply don't see this increase based on the assault weapons ban sunsetting. And frankly, the rifle has always been a staple of the law enforcement, equipment. It goes back to the days of the cowboys. They've always had a long gun in their personal, equipment arsenal, if you will. And it just transitioned to shotgun at one period, and now it's transitioning a little bit more back to the rifle, especially in urban areas where a shotgun and its spread of buckshot pellets is actually more of a safety concern because of who else you might hit with the projectiles.
I'm going to get into the issue of the different kinds of guns in a moment, but when you say you didn't get a flurry of phone calls after the sunsetting of the law, certainly that's a different kind of issue than any event like the situation with Katrina or the North Hollywood shootout or one of these incidents where somebody comes and shoots up a high school with the weapons and the police feel that they are inadequately armed, isn't it?
Yeah, it is different, but we haven't seen a surge. I think that what the IACP is implying is that the trigger is the sunsetting of the ban, and that's simply not the case. If you say since 2004, have you been looking to upgrade? You can ask tons of agencies, and they'll say, yeah, absolutely. But they were thinking about that in 2003, and 2002, and 2001, especially 2001. And we saw that, with major cities after the terrorist attacks on September 11th. You have major events that trigger response in law enforcement. I gave the example to some folks that the portable defibrillator, obviously not a weapon, but no one ever thought that we'd have those in police cars, and never a need for an agency to go out and buy hundreds of them to equip cars, but they have them now. Why? Because an event triggers that, and they need to have that capability. The rifle just expands the capability of an officer responding to a situation. 99.9% of the time, they're never, ever going to have to use it. Maybe 100% of the time, in the course of their career, they may never use that. There are officers who never draw their pistol and fire it in a dangerous situation beyond, on the range for qualifying. But they have that in the event that something happens, and they need that. That's why they have that equipment. It's why they have a portable defibrillator. It's why they have, computers for communications now. It's why they have, bulletproof vests in the event there is a shooting. But the notion that the sunset of the ban is triggering, a flood is, we simply don't see it, and we're the ones selling the firearms.
Paul Ehrhardt with SIG Arms, a major manufacturer of firearms and supplier of law enforcement nationwide. We'll talk more, as I indicated in a moment, about the capacity of various different kinds of guns. First, let me introduce Kristen Rand, legislative director for the Violence Poverty Center in Washington. That's a gun control organization. Kristen Rand, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's Violence Policy Center, actually.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We wondered about the word. Obviously, we got it wrong. Violence Policy Center, thank you very much for that.
Sure.
You have been arguing, I believe, for a reinstatement of the assault weapons ban. What's the argument for it if, in fact, there's some question about whether or not its sunsetting triggered an increase in weaponry?
Well, actually, the Violence Policy Center has always been critical of the 94 version of the assault weapons ban, which really wasn't very effective at banning a lot of assault weapons that were out on the market. Most of the guns banned by that law came back on the market almost immediately after the ban went into place. What we're advocating is a California-style assault weapons ban for the nation. California, in 1999, upgraded their assault weapons ban to effectively ban all assault weapons. And that is what we would like to see put in place nationwide, because we are definitely seeing an increase in the use of assault weapons. But we agree the trigger is not the expiration of the ban, but a general increase in homicide and gun crime in general. That there's more people out there committing more murders and more gun crime, and they're using more assault weapons.
We asked the International Association of Chiefs of Police to come on our program. They declined, said they weren't available. Do you think, Kristen Rand, this has been alleged by others, that what they're doing here, in fact, is trying to get more money for their law enforcement activities around the country so that they can buy more guns?
Well, I mean, we think a much better approach than having an arms race between criminals and the police is to disarm the criminal element, that an effective assault weapons ban will work much better than increasing the armament used by police. We've been doing that for decades. When police move from six-shot revolvers to high-capacity semi-automatic pistols, the violence out on the streets just keeps getting worse. We think that's going in the wrong direction, and that a smarter policy option is a California-style assault weapons ban, where we're seeing police in California say California's ban has been effective in reducing the number of assault weapons carried by suspects, even though many criminals are able to get around that law by going to neighboring states. But if we had that as a national law, we'd really be getting at the guts of the problem.
Okay. We've heard the term assault weapon. We've heard select fire rifle. We've heard military-style weaponry. Kristen Rand, how do you define an assault weapon, whether you're doing it in California or someplace else?
Well, basically what we're talking about here are semi-automatic assault weapons. Full automatic firearms have basically been strictly regulated for civilian use since 1934 and were essentially banned for civilians in 1986. There's a small pool that you can still legally own. But what we're talking about here are semi-automatic versions of those guns. And basically, an assault weapon is a gun that was designed for use on the battlefield because regular old hunting rifles and regular style rifles simply weren't effective enough on the battlefield. They didn't have high enough capacity. You couldn't reload them quickly enough. They weren't portable enough. They're not concealable enough. So assault weapons incorporate characteristics such as a pistol grip on a rifle, ability to take a detachable ammunition magazine, which gives you high capacity and the ability to quickly reload, all of those characteristics that soldiers need on the battlefield. And that's why we say these guns aren't just regular old hunting rifles. They're different, and they don't belong in civilian hands.
Kristen Rand, again, Legislative Director for the Violence Policy Center in Washington. Paul Earhart, we're going to have to go to a break in a moment, but let me get back to you, spokesperson for the SIGARMS, firearms manufacturer. You may not agree with much that Kristen Rand has to say, but do you agree that that's an adequate definition of an assault weapon?
No, assault weapons are a term driven by folks who are trying to ban the guns. It's a semi-automatic rifle. For instance, the Browning BAR rifle was a Browning automatic rifle. They make a semi-automatic version. It's actually a very popular, widely used hunting rifle that if you change the stock and forend, all of a sudden it's much more similar to what was used in World War II, just not full auto as that one was. It's kind of like, you know, their argument is you have a Corvette, you put a spoiler on it, you put some other things, make it look flashy. Big, it's an assault car.
As I said, okay, we're going to a break. We'll come back. We'll clarify these terms to talk more about assault weapons and their use by the police and their availability to others as well. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk about Anna Nicole Smith and classic melodrama on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Once again, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, a lobby in Washington, says that since the assault weapons ban, federal assault weapons ban, expired in 2004, there have been more of such weapons on the street. Consequently, police departments are upping their arms in order not to be outgunned. We'll talk more about the assault weapons ban in a moment. What we're talking about right now are the weapons themselves, and with Paul Earhart, who is the spokesperson for SIGARMS, a supplier to many local law enforcement agencies. So you mentioned earlier the select fire rifle. Can that be turned into the kind of weapon that soldiers use in combat?
Well, a select fire rifle is what they use. Select fire means you can select different rates of fire, semi-auto, a three-round burst, or full auto. That's a highly controlled rifle. We have to go through a lot of hoops to sell that kind of rifle to even law enforcement in the U.S., even the federal government. We have to jump through a lot of hoops to do that. The average citizen has an amazing amount of difficulty trying to get approval to buy such a rifle. So that's really a non-issue entirely.
Is there, however, an increase in sales of those to police departments?
Select fire? Well, there are in the cases because it's a special weapon. It falls, you know, that SW and SWAT is for special weapons. Law enforcement agencies have bought more select fire rifles. They've bought more tactical rifles for their snipers. They buy, you know, highly specialized equipment. And you do see that. The Salt Lake County Sheriff's Department, prior to September 11th, I don't think was, you know, adequately prepared for the security level it would have to maintain after September 11th events to make sure that the Olympics in Salt Lake City were secure. They actually bought rifles from us, and because of the need was to maintain security was extreme at that point, as you can imagine. That event triggered, you know, agencies around the country to buy firearms that they might need to control an event. I go back to Katrina. Katrina showed us how quickly a major city can go from normalcy to complete chaos. And when, you know, you talk to any law enforcement officials that went down there as volunteers, almost all of them took a rifle down with them, took an AR or something like that down there with them. Why? Because you were in a situation of complete chaos.
Okay, so again, you're saying then there may have been an increase in the purchase of these kinds of weapons by police departments, but it's triggered by events. Not by the sunsetting of the assault weapons.
Absolutely.
Ban. Okay. Again, Paul Earhart with SIG Arms. Whit Collins is former editor of Guns and Ammo magazine. He's widely read as a freelance writer on guns and gun safety, and he's a trainer who specializes in the safe use of lethal weapons. Whit Collins, always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
It was said earlier by Kristen Rand that the California-style ban adopted in 1999 would be a more effective way to do this than it was the federal assault weapons ban. From your standpoint, what's the difference?
Well, it progressed through a similar ban to the federal by rostering into a means of gauging the characteristics of arms in such a way as to be able to define them as assault arms or military-style rifles that are a serious threat within our communities.
Okay. Earlier, Kristen Rand said that part of the problem was that gun manufacturers with a federal ban could essentially relabel the guns because of the way the law was written. Talk a bit about how in the law you define these characteristics and what's effective and what isn't.
Well, if you're talking about the actual design characteristics, you have to remember that you have a combination of a gun and cartridge. When you have a family of guns called the AR family or the AK family, you can be pretty sure that you know basically what ammunition is being fired in them, and that is ammunition that's been optimized for military use to begin with and progresses through its markets and its uses with the same pattern of guns that it was designed for. That would be both our AR-15, M16 ammunition and also the Russian ammunition, which came out for use in the AK-47 and also another somewhat similar rifle called the SKS, which is also popular in this country. They both have the same fire effect because they are rapid-firing semi-automatics and either are adapted to removable magazines of different capacities or can easily be adapted to them. I would make the point that the so-called civilian versions can sometimes be very easily converted to fully automatic also. And I believe that was noted by the first author that you talked with today.
So, in other words, then, you to avoid this issue of a relabeling of the same gun, you look at the kind of ammunition that they are designed to fire. That's one way of telling whether they can be whether they either are or can be converted to this military-style automatic firing.
That would be one way. And the issue of the pistol grip, it's nearly funny. The nature of a combat arm is to use ammunition that itself is very compact so that you can have a short overall assembly. And that ammunition has to flow through freely through either fully automatic or semi-automatic arms in large quantity and not be so powerful that it heats the gun up to the point of failure. And when you combine that with the ability for a high capacity of ammunition and a pistol grip by which to control a light, short gun, not terribly powerful at long range, but very powerful at close range, which is where the fighting gets done. And that's a high volume of fire rather than very powerful cartridges. Then you have something that hides almost as well as a handgun, especially if it has a folding or telescoping stock, which is another aspect of the characteristics you look for. The issue of the bayonet lug is always brought up as kind of a red herring. No, you don't need a bayonet lug unless you really need one for a soldier. But the pistol grip and the high capacity and the overall paramilitary design and ammunition combined are the type of item that show you you have a gun that is characteristically a high volume of fire combat shoulder arm.
And high volume of fire combat, as you indicated, means not for accuracy so much as for spraying around and just sort of wiping out everything in front of you, is that?
Well, that would be, you'd be in a terrible emergency with that. And some of them are really quite accurate, but you can take a position of advantage and decimate a small unit of other people. And if they happen to be unarmed civilians, then it doesn't matter whether it's a perfect definition of assault or not.
Okay, Whit Collins, again, former editor, Guns and Ammo magazine. Back to Paul Ehrhardt with the SIG arms. Would you object to a federal law that took that kind of approach to ban the characteristics of weapons in such a way that civilians could not get hold of them?
The answer to your question is yes. The pistol grip is an issue of ergonomics. It doesn't mean it's a combat gun. You have turkey hunting shotguns that have pistol grips, for God's sakes. It makes it more ergonomic to handle the firearm. It's just easier on you to shoot. The pistol grip also means, and the AR platform is easier to train on as well. It's a very simplistic gun to use. It's built for durability as well, and it is highly accurate. The AR owns most of the long-range records and competitions, and the fact that you're talking about banning them outright is absurd because they've always been available even during the assault weapon ban period. Versions of them have always been available, but there hasn't been any kind of increase. You're always going to have that Hollywood shootout occur at some point in history. You're going to always have a Bonnie and Clyde. The question is, when will the next Bonnie and Clyde emerge? You had the FBI shootout. These are few and far between. The issue with that is you will always have them, but that event is not on the increase. Now, you're talking about taking away guns or not selling guns to legal, citizens who, in order to get the gun, have to go through an FBI background check through the NICS system. They're perfectly, capable of owning a firearm. They're law-abiding citizens. To simply say, well, this looks like it's a gun that was in the movies or on TV or I saw it on the news in Iraq, is foolish. Not to mention, this gun is just like the firearms that came back from World War II and Korea. This, those men and women who served, and mostly men at that time, obviously, who served with those rifles that he used in a military setting, come back and, seek out those rifles because those are the rifles they're used to shooting. They're used to working with. They know the rifle. Many of them use those rifles for hunting in many cases. And you can use an AR for hunting. It's not appropriate for large game, but for certain game, it's very appropriate and fun to shoot. The notion that because it was designed and used heavily by the military means it is, an evil weapon, it has to come off the streets. It's just foolhardy. And that's what people who want to ban guns would have you believe. But the notion of the pistol grip being some kind of indicator of combat. It's a function of ergonomics so that the gun can be shot accurately.
Okay.
And these guns are very, very accurate.
Paul Earhart with Sig Arms. Kristen Rand, back to you, Legislative Director for the Violence Policy Center. Mr. Earhart makes the argument that there's a lot of uses for these kinds of weapons. How would you design a ban such that sporting people, hunters and others, could continue to do what they want to do, but we wouldn't have on the streets the sorts of, for civilian use, the sorts of military use weapons you're concerned about?
Well, there are plenty of hunting and sporting guns on the market in California right now, and California has an effective assault weapons ban. And I think it's important to step back and say, this is a question of public safety. Assault weapons are a horrendous public safety threat to law enforcement officers. Our organization did a study showing that from 1998 through 2001, which were the latest numbers we were able to get from the FBI, one out of five law enforcement officers slain in the line of duty was killed with an assault weapon. That is a public safety hazard. Mass shootings like the horrendous shooting in 1989, the Stockton Schoolyard Massacre, the horrible shooting before that in San Ysidro, California, the McDonald's, Columbine was perpetrated with assault weapons. This is a public safety menace, and the interests in the public of being protected from these guns should trump the interests of hunters and shooters who can always find something else to target shoot with, to hunt with, to do with whatever they would like to do with their sporting guns. They can do it without assault weapons.
Whit Collins, back to you. Again, the former editor of Guns and Ammo. You do a lot of work with the gun safety, safety designs of weapons, weapons that perhaps ultimately will be able to be designed so only one person could use them. You train people in the safe way of storing weapons around their homes. What about the difference between the California law and the federal law? Has California been able to successfully ban these weapons in some instances, but still allow for the kinds of uses that Paul Earhart says are very legitimate?
Well, I think that as long as we have a piecemeal regulation between the states, we will have a series of porous markets. But on the whole, California's regulation as written makes it easier to discern and to keep from being brought into the state that particular class of arm, which includes, and has some others that we seldom see, but it includes the ones that make the most problem, and those are the AR and the AK families.
So what's the record been in California, or is anybody keeping track to know whether or not there's been more or less use of such weapons because of the law?
It's very difficult to get good figures. I am not sure what has been taken, for instance, in confiscation since the national ban sunset, but I know that there were a lot of people springing up to sell what were called legal substitute arms during the ban, who have now geared up to go into full-blown assault pattern arms. And they are promoting and selling more heavily than ever. If you went back and looked at gun magazines, or if you could recall what was being offered in very early internet gun sales when the ban came in federally, you would see a high increase in more offerings and parts and special accessories and materials like that, all toward the paramilitary buyer. And I would make the point that we have a three-way arms race on our streets. It's an arms race, yes, between criminals and police, but the third set of buyers, and they're the biggest set of buyers, are civilians who have become interested in these things for a variety of reasons, including a sort of a fashionable-to-own issue. The firearms industry is very much like the high-performance car industry, that they need a line of something that is supposed to be the hottest setup, and for a lot of people, and you can see this all over the internet, the hot setup is an assault-style civilian rifle.
Okay, we're going to leave that issue there for the moment. Obviously, we will not resolve it on this program. I want to very quickly deal with yet another issue that has to do with the availability of assault-style weapons. Chris Hawley is based in Mexico City for the Arizona Republic and has recently written about what's described by law enforcement people in Mexico as a flood of assault weapons down there. Chris Hawley, welcome to you.
Hi there.
Tell us what you hear.
Well, the Mexican authorities are complaining that, especially since the end of the assault weapons ban, they're seeing an increasing amount of these types of weapons. The number of assault-style weapons has risen dramatically. The number of weapons in general has tripled over the last couple of years, and it's kind of fed an arms race among different drug gangs.
To describe some of the incidents that they talk about where these kinds of weaponry are used by drug gangs.
Well, almost every week we have some sort of shootout. I wrote about an attack in a little town called Sosalpa where a bunch of guys showed up with the AR-15s and rounded up everyone in the village and then just raked the town with bullets for several minutes and shot up pretty much everything in the town, houses, vehicles, even the cows.
Earlier on our program, there was some talk about the assault weapons ban and its ineffectiveness. I'm just interested in whether it's possible that the Mexican authorities could be attributing an increase in the use of these weapons to the sunsetting of the ban as a sort of an easy explanation when, in fact, it might actually have occurred earlier than that or be due to some other reason.
Yes, that's true, and the SIG the gentleman from SIG Arms is correct that the demand side of it is a big part of this equation. And in 2003, the head of the Gulf Cartel was arrested, and it set off a turf war in places, especially in Nuevo Laredo, on the other side of the border from Laredo, Texas. And this has fed an arms race between the Sinaloa Cartel, the Juarez Cartel, and the Gulf Cartel, and all of them are arming up. So, a lot of it has to do with the demand. But if you talk to police along the border, if you talk to ATF agents along the border, and if you talk to people in the Mexican Attorney General's office there, they all say that they are seizing a larger number of assault-style weapons, especially AR-15s.
And they believe they're coming from the United States.
Yeah, there's almost no doubt. They say 90% of the assault-style weapons they seize, well, actually 90% of all the weapons they seize come from the United States. And often, you know, when they put out a press release or something saying they've seized, you know, 30 AR-15s, a lot of the brand names are American, Olympic Arms, Panther Arms, these manufacturers.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Chris Hawley, Mexico City-based reporter for the Arizona Republic. Thanks to Whit Collins, the former editor of Guns and Ammo, now a safety and weaponry expert. To Paul Earhart, spokesperson for SIG Arms. Kirsten Rand with the Violence Policy Center. And our first guest, Kevin Johnson, reporter with USA Today. Thanks so much to all of you for being with us today. The travails of Anna Nicole Smith in life and death have moved from the tabloids and cable television to the Washington Post and the New York Times. Media critics have wondered why the coverage now blankets all of journalism, from the sensational to the supposedly serious. In a moment, an English professor of English literature who says he has the answer on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Anna Nicole Smith story is the stuff of classic literature. That's according to John Sutherland, Professor Emeritus of Literature at University College London. He's also a visiting professor at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. Professor Sutherland, thanks very much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
What does Anna Nicole Smith have to do with classic literature?
Well, I think it's not like classic literature as narrative. It always seemed to me that we make sense out of our lives with stories. I mean, from the nursery until our kind of dying day, practically, we surround ourselves with stories and fiction, good stories. I mean, newspaper people talk about the good story, and novelists, of course, talk about the good story. 100% of what we go and see in movies is stories, fiction. It never happened. And yet somehow it puts us in touch with something we think is very real. And I think that's true of the Anna Nicole Smith story. It's just been on the highest toned, most austere news channel in Britain. I was watching it 2 minutes ago on Channel 4 News, and they highlighted it. Why? Because, in fact, I think they felt it said something about, to be grand about it, the human condition.
You don't think that it appeals to purency and voyeurism and all those things that we tend to think are bad?
Well, they're bad but fun. I mean, of course they do. Yes, I mean, watching that judge break down in a kind of, as it were, cascade of tears. One did wonder whether he was actually going for the Oscar or something. And it was. I mean, the fact is, yes. But there's nothing wrong with that. It seems to me that it's just a very. The fact is, it's a very sad story, like the Britney Spears saga. Is you're seeing a human being really in a stressed situation and possibly in a very dangerous situation. And you know, what one shouldn't perhaps be too much like, you know, the kind of spectators in the Roman amphitheater, you know, seeing the Christians being devoured by the lions. But there is an element of that. It seems to me, that we do actually find things in ourselves which are perhaps not very admirable, but nonetheless, it is very odd, you know, this kind of addiction that we have to stories like the Anna Nicole Smith story, which in fact people are not terribly interested, I think, at the end of the day about who's going to get this fortune. What they like is the kind of the contours, the shapes, and what it tells us about our own lives, really, that they may too have interesting shapes.
John Sutherland, English professor in London. You wrote today in the Los Angeles Times an article in which you compare the elements of the Anna Nicole Smith story to Anthony Trollope, the 19th century English novelist. Tell us what the similarities are.
Yeah, well, the similarities, in fact, I think, you know, very, very direct, in that many of Trollope's novels, the Eustace Diamonds, for instance, Is He Pope and Joy, which is not a novel that even Trollopeans know terribly well, but they're about things like inheritance. They're about, you know, is this person really the heir to a vast story? Now, that, in fact, is directly paralleled in what's going on in the Smith saga. I mean, and also, you know, Trollope has these situations where a number of people propose themselves as heirs or as the parents of heirs, which, again, is Nicole Smith. Who is going to end up with all this loot? Who, in fact, is going to benefit by this will? You know, the Victorian fiction is absolutely replete with narrative, with plots like that. It's one of their great standbys. Sensational fiction, as they called it, you know, has very, very, very close connections to what we think of as sensational journalism. And I always think, when I see people with the Washington Post, they've probably got the National Enquirer folded up inside there as well. I mean, there's a big overlap.
In its time, was the work of Trollope referred to in the same way that people refer to sensational journalism now as they are holding their noses?
Well, I mean, people looked down on it. I mean, they thought that it was rather a low taste, you know, to read novels. It took a long time before, you know, even great writers like Dickens, in fact, made it into a kind of respectable literary company. All very well, but damned low, said one critic of Oliver Twist, which, again, you know, is about sort of an heir who's dispossessed and, you know, who, in fact, eventually comes back into his fortune, which, as I said, one of the big sort of standby plots in Victorian fiction. But yes, Trollope, I think, was probably more respectable than novelists like Wilkie Collins, who were called sensationalists and were prepared to be called that and enjoyed, actually, sort of, as it were, sort of putting an electric shock through their readers.
What makes a similar story more or less respectable?
Time, usually. In fact, you'll find a lot of literature which was regarded as pretty kind of sort of pretty crass and sort of low taste, eventually sort of, you know, with the passing of time becomes very respectable. I mean, who would have thought, for instance, that The Miller's Tale by Chaucer, one of the dirtiest stories in English literature, would one day be set, as it now is, for examination for the English school children. You know, time actually sort of sanitizes a lot. But it is interesting, it seems to me, that our fascination, I think there's nothing. I don't find it sort of, as it were, sort of evidence of some terrible degradation of public taste. I think it tells us something about ourselves, and I think also that at the end of the day, that probably when that judge broke down in tears in Florida, you did feel that perhaps he was feeling something. You know, at last, you know, someone was feeling really sorry for the, you know, the kind of the victims in this kind of
strange kind of melodrama.
Well, do you think at Harvard and Yale and English and University College London, where you have been a professor, that in time they will be teaching the story of Anna Nicole Smith?
Well, I'm sure media studies people at this moment are actually sort of going out to publishers and offering probably very unreadable treatises on the subject. I think the academic mills will grind away and probably, you know. But the thing is, you know, that it's one of the things that, you know, one of the things that keeps us alive, I think. I'm rather glad that, in fact, it's sort of it's so foregrounded. And I don't think people are escaping from the really kind of horrible things, you know, the kind of Iraq and the sort of the global climate change and things. I think they're still there and in the kind of frame. I think, you know, but this in fact, you know, testifies to our kind of common humanity.
We only have a moment left, but in the interest of making a contrast between high and low culture, in your story in the Los Angeles Times, you talk about Celebrity Big Brother, the TV show in England, 9 million viewers, and when one person inquired, one young woman inquired of the other what she was looking for in a husband, she replied, oil. What did you mean by oil?
Old, ill, and loaded. I think once you hear that, you never forget it. And yeah. I think probably that also, of course, is one of the main constituents in the Anna Nicole Smith plot, that he was very old, he was very ill, and extremely loaded.
And that was, of course, the case in the Trollope book that you referred to earlier.
Yeah, I mean, beautiful young women actually sort of mysteriously falling in love with very old, rich, and not terribly attractive men is, in fact, again, one of the recurrent features of that fiction. And also, of course, it tells us something about the way in which you organize our own lives very often.
Old, ill, and loaded. Remember, you heard it here. John Sutherland, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Professor Emeritus of English Literature, University College London, visiting professor at Caltech in California. Producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Dan Konecki, and Vanessa Romo. Our technical director, Phoebe Zimmerman. Managing producer, Karen Radziner. Special thanks to Karina Miller. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.